Yeah. Okay. So our sitting group actually began a little over 20 years ago, and it began as a four-part introductory series on the foundations of mindfulness, based on the Buddhist teaching and the greater discourse on the foundations of mindfulness. And it was intended originally as just kind of a one-off little month-long course. And at the end of that course, the people who'd been a part of that said, you know, we would really like to just continue to meet on an ongoing basis. And so we did. You know, we began to meet weekly. We were first in the basement of an apartment building in the Cole neighborhood. And then we later on learned of the availability of the upstairs chapel at the First Unitarian Church at 14th and Lafayette. And so we met together there weekly for about 15 years. And then when they had to go undergo a bunch of renovation work, that we moved to St. Barnabas. But the genesis, the very beginning of our Sangha was just this little four part month-long series, an instructional series on very detailed introduction to insight meditation or mindfulness meditation. And so what we've done over the years is kind of continue that tradition. So in addition to our weekly meetings, once a year during the month of October, what we do is to replicate the experience that gave birth to the Sangha in the first place. And so for people who really either want to, for the first time, get grounded in the essentials and in the details of what the Buddha taught about doing mindfulness meditation, it's a great opportunity to do that. And for those of us who've been doing this practice for a really long time, it is also an opportunity to kind of reground ourselves and remind ourselves about, you know, why we do this practice and what the essential elements of it are. And I think that's been my experience and probably that of a lot of people in the Sangha, that no matter how many times we've heard it, that each time it comes around, it kind of awakens something or reminds us of some aspect of our practice that we may have forgotten or may not have been attending to. So it's kind of a freshening or refreshing or reawakening to the essentials of the practice for some of us who've been doing it a long time. And then for others who have not, it's like taking one's understanding to a deeper level. So, you know, one of the most famous Buddhist meditation guides in the United States over the last half century has been Suzuki Roshi, the Zen master's little book, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. And so what this is, he said, what Suzuki Roshi said, it was an introduction to Zen meditation, but at the same time he said, in order for your practice, no matter how long you've been doing it, or whatever tradition you've been doing it in order for it to continue to have the juice and the energy and the force and the vibrant effect, it's always helpful if every time you can sit as a beginner. You can sit as someone who's never done this before and who is fresh to the experience and who is open to whatever happens in the moment. So it's an opportunity for all of us to once again experience beginner's mind. So, oh, right. Yeah, okay, here we are. Here we are. Like coming back to home base, you know, getting refueled. So that's why we do that. And that we're going to be doing that every Sunday night in October, first four Sundays in October, just as we have been for quite a long time. Very long, abstruse answer to a short, simple question.
Thank you.
Okay. Anything else? Okay. Well, then here we are. Quite a few years ago, my wife Abby and I were with some friends, and there were two couples. We had organized a month-long backpacking journey through northern Italy, and it included a week-long stay in Florence. And while we were there, we went on a couple of these guided tours to the different chapels that were around the town of Florence. And the little hotel we were staying in had once been a grand villa owned by the Scotti family of Florence. And the Scottis were not as large or as well known as the Medicis, but they were really rich. And the reason was because they had specialized in the silk trade. First by trading, establishing trading routes and contacts and networks to import Chinese silk. But what they did at the same time is that they developed this network of spies to go over to China and figure out how they made silk. And so they were among those who brought the technology for making silk to Europe and became fabulously wealthy in the process. And so they had nice digs. So it was a nice place to stay. And we would go to each of these really wealthy families in Florence. What they did was they would build family chapels here and there around the city, where the families would go to practice. And you'd go to, do the Catholic rituals that were, woven into their culture and their way of life. And then what they would do about, one or two days a week is they would invite in the public to come see and experience these chapels where they practice. And what they had done was to commission some of the best artists in Florence to come in and paint murals on the walls of the chapels. And they would, some of the best, most talented artists of the time in Florence. And so they would paint these murals that depicted different scenes in the life of Jesus, from his birth to his practice and his teaching and until his arrests and persecution and his sacrifice. So but what these families did when they commissioned these artists to paint these pictures is that they would paint one or two family members into the scenes. So the understanding being that the peasants, the ones who were actually like making the silk and doing the scut work and whatnot, were pretty ahistorical. They were completely unlettered. And so not really much sense. So they said, oh, there's Lorenzo de' Medici at the Last Supper. Oh, there's Signore Scotti receiving the Magi on their return from the Middle East, right? So it was, it was this over-the-top kind of propaganda, but nonetheless, these were kind of like Bible stories. These were the way that the people who couldn't read, and especially then, all this stuff is still in Latin, the way that they would be taught about the teachings of Jesus and the gospel of Jesus through these paintings on the walls of these chapels. And the same is true in the time of the Buddha. The Brahmins and the recluses, the scholars, the literati, the ones who became devotees of the Buddha, the monastics, the ones who followed him around. And there was a whole class of scholars who were part of the Buddha Sangha and who had very good memories. And their job was to, and they would listen carefully to what the Buddha was teaching in one of or another of the discourses. And then afterwards, they would get together and repeat to each other what they had heard. And they would take his teachings and put them in the form of chants or a kind of a liturgy, actually. And that's how the teachings of the Buddha were handed down for the first couple hundred years after his death, which is very much the same process that was used to record and remember the teachings of Jesus of Nazareth. It's 300 years from the time he died until he started writing down what he was actually thought to have said. Similar process happened with regard to the Buddha. And so all of these really abstruse, technical, his detailed explanations of things like paticca-samuppada, how the mind creates self, and his teaching of the Eightfold Path, how the mind can be liberated from the prison of self. You know, this stuff is pretty complex. You know, this is like graduate level Buddha Dharma, right? It was the kind of stuff that his monastic scholars got off on, right? But it had very little relevance to the public as a whole. Okay. And so what eventually began to happen was that in trying to be able to convey these teachings to a wider world, to those who were not skilled, were not learned, were not literate, what began to happen, it happened to some extent in India at the time of the Buddha, but it really took off, it really flourished when Buddha Dharma came to Tibet. And what began to happen then were these, the creation of these elaborate, detailed, vibrant tankas or artwork that tried to depict in graphic form what it was the Buddha had been talking about all those years. Okay. What his teachings about dependent origination, his teachings basically about the mechanics of how mind creates self and how it creates self in a way that perpetuates dukkha, that perpetuates suffering. And then his teachings about how in the process of awakening, in the process of self-liberation, that chain of causation can be broken. And one can become free of it. And so there are two great kind of iconic masterworks of Buddhist art, Tibetan Buddhist art, that depicts these two things. One, the depiction of the assembly line, the means by which mind creates self, unexamined mind, ignorant mind, how it goes about conjuring self, and therefore conjuring the perpetuation of suffering. The wheel of samsara. And the other great trope or image, the companion image actually, is the Eightfold Path, the eight-spoked wheel. Okay. So we have what's called the bhava chakra, how mind creates self and therefore creates or perpetuates suffering, and the dharma chakra, the means by which self-liberation can occur. And so kind of like the Bible stories painted on the walls of the chapels in Florence, those two images kind of encapsulate nearly everything the Buddha had to say about how mind creates suffering and how mind can be liberated from suffering. And so what I want to do here this evening, and I think it's probably going to take maybe a little more time because I don't want to spend the whole time just running my mouth. It might take us more than one meeting to do this, but what I wanted to do was to kind of review for us the mechanics of self-creation, the wheel of samsara, and the wheel of the dharma, self-liberation, in terms of the classic teaching about how we do it individually and apply it to what's happening in the world around us right now. Essentially, apply it to, if I gave this talk a title, it would be environmental karma, because as I've seen what's been going on, you know, especially this summer, as the skies have been filled with smoke and the terrible suffering being endured by all forms of wildlife and human life in the forested regions of the Mountain West, tragic consequences, the karmic consequences of the last 200 years of the consumption of fossil fuels. I think that the model for how the mind creates suffering for self, wheel of samsara, and how mind can be liberated by the wheel of the dharma is actually equally applicable to society as a whole. And that one way of understanding what it is that we're living through right now is to see it in that way. So at any rate, that's why it might turn out to be a two-parter. But anyhow, we'll start with the individual level, and then start moving toward the societal one. But so if you look at, maybe by next time my skills will be better, and I still haven't figured out how to do this split screen thing where you put up art and whatnot, and then you can flip back. If you have occasion to see a depiction of the wheel of samsara, sometimes also called the wheel of life, it's this big mandala, this big circular illustration, in holding the mandala at the top, with his claws, and you can see his face, and with his feet at the bottom, is Lord Yama, the Lord of Death. Right? Because the entirety of the wheel of samsara is encompassed by the Lord of Death, because what the wheel of samsara is depicting is the arising and changing and passing away of self. Right? It all happens within this environment of insubstantiality. So around, there are 12 steps in dependent origination, how consciousness encounters phenomenon and how it responds to phenomena, all that. And they're like little cartoons. If you look at it's a kind of a 12-step program of, in terms of how it's classically taught. And the first step in this process of self-creation is the arising of ignorance, which is to say the consciousness not being aware or not being able to see the extent to which it is conditioned by and driven by greed and aversion. So, when the Buddha began to teach, he was saying, these are the root causes of suffering, of dukkha, greed, hate, and delusion, attachment, aversion, and delusion. But they're, in fact, they're really only kind of exponents or kind of perversions of or scrambled DNA coming out of the very forces that helped us survive and succeed and prevail as a species, which is to seek out the pleasurable in terms of, finding enough to eat and water to drink and procreation and what. That's why we're here, because we got very good at that. But, so attachment or seeking out the pleasurable, avoiding the unpleasant or the threats and ignoring everything else. So, that's deep in our programming, and it is for nearly all sentient beings. The problem that's occurred for us as a species is that those three forces are like on steroids, and we haven't figured out how to rein them in, how to keep them from harming us. So in this model of the perpetuation of suffering, consciousness comes forth in a state of ignorance, which is not being able to see the extent to which it is influenced or affected by attachment and aversion. And then out of that ignorance, there arises the sense contact, the birth of awareness of the body, the arising of memories. And this is a model of rebirth, actually. So, and it can be rebirth that's occurring from moment to moment, or in the classic sense, from the consciousness of the previous being. So at any rate, all the memories come forth, the things you liked and the things you didn't like, as being experienced in the body at this point in time. And then the body experiences the pleasant and the unpleasant and the neutral, and it's drawn toward the pleasant and away from the unpleasant, and still governed by ignorance or unawareness of what's going on, responds to the pleasant by craving and clinging, gives birth to the craving and clinging self, and then the craving and clinging self arises and passes, arises and changes and passes away, and then the whole thing starts over again. And you can think about that model, the wheel of samsara, is happening moment by moment by moment as the mind continuously recreates itself, or over this, over these periods of lifetimes. So that's the assembly line for creation of self. You set that alongside that's the bhava chakra, cultivation of sense of self. Dharma chakra, okay. What's going on there? We have the meditative factors. We learn how to meditate. We learn how to calm the mind. We bring skillful effort into play. Mindfulness begins to arise. We can see with greater and greater clarity what is in fact arising in the mind on a moment-to-moment basis. Once the mindfulness is established, we begin to develop insight into our own karmic history, be able to look back into our own past and say, oh, when I said or did this thing, it had this effect. We begin to be able to develop penetrating insight into the cause-effect relationship of all of our own past words and deeds. And it can be sobering and a little shaking, but it is a profound examination of who brought us, who we are in this moment in time. What are all the causes and conditions that gave rise to who we are right in this moment? So that's the first of the two wisdom factors, which is insight into our past. The other of the two wisdom factors is insight into our future, which is to say insight into our own intentions. When we look back at what we did and what we said or did in the past and what the effects were of having said or done those things, then there begins this process of awakening. It's like, oh, wow. Look what I did then and what the consequences were. And we can start to develop a little compassion, a little sense of self-forgiveness for things we did back then that caused us harm then and that may be continuing to cause us harm now. But the more clearly we see that, then the other wisdom factor is insight into our intentions. It's like, oh, wow. Back when I did this back then with unwholesome intention, this was the consequence. What are my intentions now in terms of my thoughts? What are my intentions in terms of what I might be about to say? What are my intentions in terms of what I might be about to do? If I can stop and reflect on my intentions based upon my knowledge of what I've done in the past, maybe I can avoid saying or doing unskillful things in the next moment, right, in the immediate future, and thereby cease to cause harm to myself and others, and begin to speak and act in ways that have a beneficial intention and a beneficial outcome. And then that manifests as wise speech and wise action and a wise way of life. So the kind of the connection between these two wheels, you know, the consciousness born into ignorance of the extent to which it's being driven by attachment and aversion. And by out of that ignorance, it replicates suffering, right? So what's happening, that's what's happening in the wheel of samsara, in the wheel of the Dharma. It's like we catch it. It's like the ignorance, we catch the ignorance in action. So instead of being ignorant of the extent to which our thoughts and our words and our deeds are driven by attachment and aversion, we awaken to the fact that they are. And that's where the freedom lies, between intention on the Dharma wheel and the manifestation in terms of speech and action. And that's kind of the point. That's the place at which it's possible to step off the wheel of samsara and onto the wheel of the Dharma. You know, basically escaping from or being freed from our own karma, the consequences of our past unskillful actions. Right? So that's the model. That's the Bible story. That those are the, you know, and if you look at the wheel of samsara, you know, there are little cartoons for each of the 12 steps, you know, that kind of describe the plight of consciousness as it goes through them. And then in the Wheel of the Dharma, there is kind of the mirror, the opposite, the say, okay, this is what happens when the mind is imprisoned by or affected by its own self-imprisonment when it comes to dukkha. This is the mind on the Eightfold Path. And holding the two together and looking at them together, you know, for those of us who are more graphically inclined than, you know, drawn by the written word, it becomes a little more clear, a little more obvious. And so the process of awakening in Buddha Dharma is learning to recognize when ignorance is keeping us from being able to see the extent to which craving and clinging and aversion are coloring the way we see the world and are coloring or affecting the way we speak and act. Awakening is awakening to the existence of those forces, and having awakened to them or having recognized them, having seen them for what they are, not acting on them. So those are the two wheels, the bhava chakra, the cultivation of self, the dharma chakra, the liberation from self. So let's talk about those two for a little while. I'd really like to, you know, entertain some sharing of views around that. And that may be as far as we get tonight, or we might be able to move on to say, okay, how does this apply to the situation we find ourselves in with regard to our environment and climate? So please, thoughts, reflections, questions. Paul?
Oh, I'm a person of images as well. And as you were talking about stepping from one wheel onto another, I'm thinking about the rodeo, the Western rodeo, where this poor character is riding on the bull. And the bull is in full rage, and the rider is doing his or her utmost to stay on the bull. And then when the buzzer goes off, along comes a nice character with a nice horse that sort of rescues that individual. And I think of that as sort of the refuge of the Dharma. Get me off the damn bull.
Yes. Well done. Thank you. Thank you. One of my favorite Chinese stories from Chinese from Taoism is that of a young man who goes out and manages to capture this really wild, powerful feral horse that's been hanging out in the hills around the village. And he's a very skilled horseman. He comes back and brings this horse back on a lead and starts to try to tame it and get it sufficiently calm to where he might be able to start to ride it. And so he begins to do that. And then eventually he manages to get on the horse. But as soon as he does so, the horse just takes off on a mad gallop through the village. And one of his neighbors calls out to him, where are you going in such a hurry? And the hapless rider responds, I don't know, ask the horse. Yeah, it's like, sometimes, like you were saying, sometimes it's like we're just along for the ride, you know? And so, yeah, it's really nice if there's somebody. Of course, the reason the bull is bucking, and those horses are doing it, is because there's a strap wrapped around their scrotum, and all they're trying to do is get rid of that. And so, if you've ever noticed a bucking bronco or a bucking bull, what they do after the rider either gets thrown or ends the ride is they just come along and release the strap, and then they just stop, you know, it's because they were bucking because they were being tortured, you know. So there's probably some little Dharma lesson in there as well. It's like, you know, the reason we're jumping around so much is because we're being tortured, you know, we're being tortured by our our aversions or, you know, our greed.
Perhaps that's what we're doing with our Mother Earth right now.
Too true. Thank you. I appreciate that. Other thoughts or reflections or comments or questions, please.
Well, the ox herding pictures, I thought each of those stories was going to end up being the ox herding pictures, but that's still something else.
Oh, say more.
Those are the guide to becoming enlightened, I guess. And a young man goes out in search of the bull. I think there are 10 frames. And he goes out in search, and the first frame shows hoof prints in the sand, and then the next frame, just gradually he takes possession of the bull, and then he's able to get on it, and then he has a little flute, and he's riding the bull and playing the flute, and then the next frame is everything has disappeared, it's all gone, and the final frame is his being in the marketplace as the old man he was when he began the series of pictures.
Uh-huh. Right. Full circle. Right. Encountering the forces and taming them.
Yes.
Yeah, well done. Thank you. Okay.
Yeah, I have one other thing. Suzuki also, as you know, has Not Always So as a second book, which is very much like Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. And I'm curious about why it gets left out.
Well, tell us about it.
Well, it's the sequel. It's Suzuki 2. And it's just a continuation of compendium of his lectures, just exactly like Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind.
I see. Okay. I'll have to seek it out. Thanks. Thank you. All right. So, liberation on the individual level arises from awakening to the consequences of our past actions, both skillful and unskillful. And so when I think about what we are experiencing now, whether it's the wildfires in the mountains of the West, when the days when the skies are filled with smoke and it's dangerous to breathe the air, and it's natural to feel aversion to that. But for me, it's like we are experiencing, you know, especially in the Tibetan teachings, you know, they talk about the three kayas, the three bodies, the fear body being the individual, you know, physical body that we inhabit. And then there's what's called the rainbow body or the aural body, which is a kind of an energetic emanation that is kind of like a halo that resides around us. And then the great body of the Dharmakaya, it's the great body of which we are all a part, okay, of which we're all an element, of which we're all selves. And so when I, moving from this model of the wheel of samsara and the wheel of enlightenment or the wheel of freedom, and seeking to apply that to the Dharmakaya, to the great body of which we're all a part, I think that it really fits. Just as when we do insight meditation practice, we're training ourselves to look into first down the hallway into the caverns of our history, right? Of all the causes and conditions that gave rise to who we are in the moment. And then we look into the future, into our own intentions. It's just as if we're doing the same thing now as a civilization, as humankind. It's like what we're beginning to do is to awaken, see, oh, the smoke in the air, the flooding, these violent storms, these, you know, the disintegration of the ice caps at the North and South Pole. It's like, oh, consequence, action and consequence. We're experiencing the consequences of 200 years worth of, you know, the exploitation and the combustion of fossil fuels. And that reality, you know, we're, I think as a civilization, just now beginning to awaken to the enormity of the consequences of those actions. We are experiencing 200 years of vipaka, of the fruition of past action. Okay. And what we're seeking to do is to step off as a society, you know, environment, we're seeking to step off the wheel of samsara and onto the wheel of liberation. Okay. So the first thing that's necessary is dispelling ignorance, ignorance, you know. In the 1990s, ExxonMobil alone spent nearly $20 million on a campaign of ignorance, of deliberate misinformation, of trying to convince the public that what was being experienced was not really real. Right? That climate change was not happening, or if it was, it was a natural rhythmic behavior of nature, and it had nothing to do with the combustion of fossil fuels. It was a massive investment in a campaign of ignorance. Ultimately, it was found out, and it's been exposed, and we are now, as a civilization, awakening to the fact that radical climate change, climate heating, is real and it's happening, and it is as a result of our past actions. Okay. There is still a lot of energy and wealth being poured into the misinformation or the ignorance campaign, but it's failing. Because not only is the evidence overwhelming, the evidence is extraordinarily painful, you know, and it's beginning to traumatize not only, you know, the impoverished nations of the world, but all the nations of the world. You know, we are beginning to experience suffering on a global scale that is directly attributable to the fossil fuel consumption, and it's become undeniable. So we are awakening, as painful as that is. Then comes the question of what are we going to do about it? How hard are we going to work to begin to act beneficially instead of acting destructively? And in my view, that's the crossroads we find ourselves at right now. And for me, as somebody who has quite recently embarked on the path of recovery from abuse of alcohol in my case, and having been humbled by the experience of its powerful addictive properties, for me, it's like I feel that as a society, much the same thing is going on with regard to fossil fuels. The dependency is massive, and it feels like, that this can't be overcome, that it's just kind of woven deeply into the very fiber of our society, of our economy and whatnot. That's not really true. Freedom from that kind of dependency is possible, and it will require a lot of struggle. Whether or not one has dependency issues, like I do, but we all know, all of us who walk the Dharma path, we know that change is not easy. It's why the Buddha said to follow the Eightfold Path is like swimming upstream. It's like the salmon, You're not just kind of bobbing along, If you want to do this practice, if you want to become free of suffering, you need to work for that freedom. It requires effort. You have to want it. You have to want it more than anything. And I think that for us as a civilization, as a society, we need to collectively choose life. And that's going to entail real effort, just like walking the Dharma path. Sometimes it really is easy and the rewards can be really wonderful. There can be these feelings of peace and of joy and of contentment, and as if you just have come home, right? And the Dharma becomes who we are. And then there are other times when it's a struggle, because these forces of attachment, forces of aversion and fear, strong. And I think that just as the process of self-liberation can sometimes just be smooth and easy and natural, and other times have real difficulty, I think the transition to a way of life as a civilization that is not threatening our very continued existence is going to be difficult, is difficult, and it also has great rewards to offer, but it's not going to happen without our really wanting to and our insisting that it occur. So more thoughts, reflections, please.
Yeah, my thing on the environment of late has been about plastic. Can you hear me? Am I on?
Yeah.
Good. Okay. Yeah, it's been about plastics. I read over a year ago that it's been raining plastic, that the big giant islands the size of Texas and the North Pacific and the Indian Ocean are breaking down into macro particles and being swept up with the evaporation and hydration cycle and raining all over the earth. There's plastic everywhere. And then a friend of mine from a restaurant that I go to mentioned that there's some anecdotal evidence that this plastic embedded in the precipitation cycle could affect human reproduction. And then as a sidebar to that, and you were talking about burning fossil fuels, I saw a TV show. Actually, I saw a DVD from the library. It was Bill Nye and Arnold Schwarzenegger, of all people. And they were interviewing some NASA scientists and other environmentalists about how the ocean, its job is to try to suck the excess CO2 out of the atmosphere. That's the balancing thing. And it just wants to do that. And but when you, as it does that, it's slowly acidifying. But one thing that they thought there might be anecdotal evidence that as the ocean acidifies, it suppresses volcanic activity at the bottom of the ocean, which means that volcanic activity will move to the land. So now I don't know if that second one about volcanic activity is true, but I think there are just so many unintended consequences that we don't even know about how the Earth cycles work. And the one about plastics is, for me, it's very high on my list as an environmental activist. Mm-hmm. So, I'm searching for ways in my Buddhist practice and in my progressive liberation theology, Catholic Christian practice, to cope with these things and to do, you know, my token part to inform people about it and to change. One last thought: something that overwhelmed me about plastics was I was in a hardware store at the checkout line, and every single thing was enveloped in plastic that wasn't recyclable. Almost every single product that you would buy from the hardware store, we accepted of screws and bolts and things like that, but it was all enveloped in plastic or made of plastic. Mm-hmm. It feels overwhelming sometimes, Lloyd.
Yeah, and the same is true with packaging for foods and things of that nature. I know that it can feel overwhelming. When I think about, if we think about human society or civilization as the Dharmakaya, as one consciousness, there is the aspect of that consciousness that wants to stay asleep. And there's the aspect of that consciousness that wants to awaken. And when we think about just ourselves, the fear body, the mnemonikaya, the just little us, it can feel overwhelming, and as if there's nothing that we as individuals can do that make any difference at all. But if enough of us are awakening at the same time, for just doing what we can. So, when I'm shopping for this or that, I'm paying a lot of attention to packaging, because we tend to just not think about that so much. But if I'm looking for, like juices or things that can either come in a plastic bottle or can come in a cardboard container, then I'm more and more making purchasing choices based on what the product comes in and what's going to happen after I use the product. I think just, and that's just a kind of a minor thing, but it can make a real difference. And especially if we start make a noise about it, you know, making good trouble about demanding packaging that is not making matters worse instead of making matters better. You know, it seems a simple thing, but it can have a fairly profound effect. I think there's all kinds of ways that once we start to, and you know, and the feedstock for plastic is petroleum. You can make plastic out of anything. You can make plastic that goes away after 3 months, you know. But petroleum-based plastics are the ones that last forever. So there are solutions available to just about every problem before us. But they're not going to rise by themselves. You know, we have to be part of the process of making those come into being. Thank you, Jim.
Can I make...
Please?
I'm sorry. Can I make a quick comment?
Please. Who is this speaking?
This is Julia.
Hi, Julia.
In Boulder. A couple years ago, I went to a panel at CU sponsored by the Union of Concerned Scientists, and they had a lawyer on the panel who had formerly worked for ExxonMobil, and he said that they had spent more on fighting legal cases, or the money that they had used on fighting legal cases brought against ExxonMobil could be used to fix environmental problems. But instead, the lawyers are getting it, or the courts. But there's also, it seems to me there's a metaphor for there. I mean, in there about the ego and self-liberation and how difficult it is, the conundrum we're in. It's like, well, I need this plastic tool, so what do I do? You know, it's like, yeah.
Sometimes it feels like a form of indentured servitude. You know, that as a society, we've been born into dependence upon this way of doing things, this way of packaging our foods and packaging our other products and transporting ourselves as we do and whatnot. And so, so that in and of itself, I think can reasonably be thought of as a process of liberation, you know, as a process of liberation from continued suffering, continued dukkha, you know. And it's not to demonize, you know, the fossil fuel industry. You know, it's why we're as wealthy and technologically advanced as we are. But it's the
right. We use the oil to get to the protests.
Yeah, it's the realization that that the status quo is not sustainable. The status quo is horribly destructive, and that the status quo, you know, will ultimately be the end of us all if we don't end the status quo. Right. And this is a process. It took us 200 years to get into this fix, and it's probably going to take at least half that long to get out of it. But really? It's not like we really have a whole lot of choice anymore.
The Amish got off at an interesting moment.
Say again?
Thinking that the Amish got off the fossil fuel chain at a very interesting moment.
In the 19th century, you mean?
Yes, that they decided not to use.
Yeah.
To a large extent, and they've upheld that, and it's becoming more and more apparent that was a good choice in a way.
Yes, right, good, right. In the very place that oil was first commercially produced, in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
Interesting, okay. Please, other thoughts or reflections? We've run over time, so we're going to have to wrap it up here momentarily, but I'm really appreciating the discussion. Okay, my good friends. We have I just want to say I just really appreciate the time we spend together. And whether it's in the chapel at the church or whether it's just here online, I think what really matters at the end of the day is the just the vibrance and the texture, the network, the viability of our sangha, of our sense of connection, of our support for each other, as we continue on this really interesting journey, self-liberation. And we're going to need all the help we can get, I think, including the help of the devas. So please, I want to take us out by invoking their protection once more, if I can. Please find your sitting posture, settle in. Allowing the eyes to gently close and the attention to come to rest once more on the breathing. Bhavatu Sava Mangalam Rakanti Sava Devata. May there be every blessing, and may all the devas protect you. Sava Buddha Nubavena Sada Sati Bhavantu Te. By the power of all the Buddhas, may you always be well. Bhavatu Sava Mangalam Rakanti Sava Devata. May there be every blessing. May all the devas protect you. Sava Dhabha Nubhavena Sala Sati Bhavantute. By the power of all the dharmas, may you always be well. Bhavati Sava Mangalam Rakati Sava Devata. May there be every blessing, and may all the devas protect you. Sava Sangha Nubhavena Sada Sati Bhavantute. By the power of all the Sangha, may you always be well. Bhavatu Sava Mangalam Rakantu Sava Devata. May there be every blessing, and may all the devas protect you. Thanks for coming around this evening. Enjoyed our time together. Have a good week. Stay safe and be well.
Thank you, Caroline.
Thank you,
Lloyd.
Thank you, Tara Lloyd.
Thank you, Tara Lloyd. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tara Lloyd and everyone.
Stay safe and be well. Here we go.